everyone. Welcome to another exciting episode of the Cabot Cove Gazette, Jessica Fletcher's favorite murder podcast. I'm your host, Bridget Keys, and we're doing something a little bit different this week. This week marks the start of a new era for the Cabot Cove Gazette without our beloved former co-host TJ West. So instead, the co-host this week is you. I've asked all of you to watch the episode and send in your thoughts as audio recordings, and I'm going to put them together with my own thoughts this week, and we'll see what happens. Now, in future weeks, we're going to have different guest hosts, but we might go back to this idea of having you send in your recordings from time to time, because I think it's really fun to get to hear from all of you. So let's get started. So this episode is basically Macbeth. We have the wealthy guy whose company Jessica is on the board of, and everyone is gathering at the CEO or the president's house, Barnett, and he says he's got a big announcement for them all. He summoned them all to his house, and they're going to have this like nice weekend together, and Jessica obviously does not fit in with the rest of these people who are very materialistic, and we've got Ginny, who is essentially our Lady Macbeth. She's even wearing red. Side note, that has nothing to do with anything, but her hair is like a hot mess in this episode. And I was left wondering like what the hairstylists and makeup team were thinking. But she literally suggests to her husband that they kill Barnett. Like he's, you know, old and not well. And they're like, well, we could just push him along a little bit and then we could take over the company. Later that night, the power is cut and we hear at Jessica notices, because she is a night owl, as we've established many times on the Cabot Cove Gazette, she is such a night owl. So it's 12:15 a.m. and the lights are flickering and she looks at the clock and notices. But it's not until 7 a.m. that we hear the wife scream and the guy's dead in the bathtub and the TV is in the tub with him still plugged in. That, I have to say, is one of the murders that stands out to me when I look back across Murder, She Wrote. I always remember the guy in the bathtub, so it seems like he was electrocuted. But the doc thinks the TV fell in and gave him a heart attack. Jessica thinks maybe it was the opposite. Maybe he was in the tub having a heart attack, and he is flailing around, and it made him yank the TV into the tub with him. Regardless, there is, of course, the telltale brandy glass missing. He had brandy every night before he went to bed, and the glass is missing. So, of course, we know he was probably poisoned. So eventually, Jessica talks to a doctor and suggests that we check for an overdose. In the meantime, there's all these board shenanigans going on. So they call an emergency board meeting. They're trying to figure out how the company is going to move forward. Someone tries to convince Jessica she doesn't need to be there for it. And she's like, LOL, I wasn't born yesterday. Some other guy blows in from out of town and he's a total asshole. And at this point, Jessica knows that these people are just trying to scheme to take over the company. In fact, one of the guys, played by Roy Walston, is on the phone with a guy who was actively trying to complete a hostile takeover. And so she knows that he's sort of like a mole, you know, spying on what's going on inside the board. And Jessica is really off put by this. I mean, she, you know, this is like, I think TJ and I used to talk a lot about how Murder, She Wrote would reflect on 1980s Reaganism. And it was always very sharply critical of this sort of materialistic turn that society had taken. And I think this episode in many ways is really emblematic of that. We have Jessica saying, literally, a man has died and you all seem more interested in making your own deals and cutting each other's throats. So she's really advocating that they work together as a board for the sake of the company to compromise instead of compete against each other. And this is why we love Jessica, right? She's not cutthroat, gung-ho, money, 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 the way that it seems like everyone else is. So we have a bunch of suspects who could have possibly killed Barnett in this episode. I mean, we have Lady Macbeth and her husband, who's played by the guy who plays Lee Nollis in Star Trek Deep Space Nine, who we've seen in Murder, She Wrote before, and I always call him Lee Nollis. The two of them are actually kind of concerned that they might have killed Barnett. So they did, in fact, tamper with his brandy glass. And when Jessica confronts them, they start bickering and immediately give themselves away. So they're pretty terrible as murderers. And Jessica's like, whatever, I don't care about this. I just want to know if you saw somebody going into his bathroom because the brandy wasn't what killed him. And Lady Macbeth just keeps going on and on. Ginny, the character's name, she just keeps going on and on about what a great plan this was. Like, we devised this amazing murder plan and it didn't work. Like, okay, lady, I don't think that you did devise a really great murder plan because, number one, you didn't murder him. And number two, you're like readily confessing to what you had done. But in true Murder, She Wrote fashion, you know, this is the thing we see in Murder, She Wrote a lot, that someone intends to kill someone, but what they do isn't the thing that actually kills the person. And in Murder, She Wrote logic, that makes them sort of innocent, which is like totally terrifying, I think. Eventually, they admit to Jessica, though, that they heard a woman in the bathroom with our murder victim, Barnett. So there was someone else in there. So Barnett, our murder victim, was having an affair with someone. His wife tells Jessica she could just feel it. And she suspects that it was the woman who was serving as vice president of the company who's also on the board. And I think this is really interesting for a couple of reasons. You know, that sense that like she just sort of intrinsically knew something was happening. And he was having an affair, Jessica determines, and I'll get to that in a second. But the fact that she suspected it was this woman who had worked her way up the ranks of the company and become vice president, you know, it speaks to the sort of cynicism that we often see in the 1980s about women's success. And that's something we've seen in other Murder, She Wrote episodes. But this woman has worked her way up, and she actually is one of the few people who, in those boardroom scenes, isn't a total monster. I mean, she is looking out for the interest of the company. She's trying to do a good job. And ultimately, at the end of the episode, she ends up being appointed chairperson of the board. So Jessica says she's already making choices that are good for business and good for society. And in the final moment of the episode, Jessica says she thinks the company is probably in really good hands. And they share a handshake and a smile. This is kind of a really nice ending. But it also means that our lady VP is not actually a suspect, right? And she wasn't the one having the affair. What we actually learn is that Barnett's affair was with the girlfriend of his corporate rival, Osborne, someone who is, in contrast to the lady vice president, you know, I think they're pitted sort of against each other as two opposite models of femininity. The girlfriend is much more of a sort of, you know, sleazy tart type. And she is played by Jenny Lee Harrison, who was Suzanne Summers' replacement on Three's Company. When Jessica inspects the bathroom again, she finds a little gold charm. So this is proof that someone was in the bathroom with him and that he didn't actually die of a heart attack. The doctor confirms that it was digitalis. So those of you who are murder aficionados, you know that digitalis comes from foxglove. And at this point in human history, like, I don't understand why anyone is growing foxglove or planting it in their gardens. Like, do people not listen to enough murder mysteries? I was at the farmer's market this summer and they were straight up selling murder. I took a picture of it and sent it to my friend who also loves murder mysteries. And I was like, look at this. They're straight up selling murder at the farmer's market. What they were selling was foxglove plants. But I'm like, that's what people use it for, right? It's so toxic. And it doesn't even have to be like ingested. You could just absorb it through the skin. So it's like, you guys, it's a pretty flower. Why are we growing this? I found some in my front yard wild last summer and it terrified me. Like, who's trying to murder me? Anyway, it was digitalis poisoning. So at the beginning of the episode, Barnett has assigned everyone to their rooms in his house, and he's put Osborne, this guy who's trying to enact a hostile takeover of his company, in the adjoining room next to him. So Jessica determines that what happened was the girlfriend of Osborne was actually having an affair with Barnett, and Barnett told her to go date Osborne so that she could serve as a spy. And Jessica is like, well, this is really messy, but she says she's not going to tell Barnett's wife because at this point it would just be more harmful to her than to learn the full truth. So in addition to Lady Macbeth and her husband, Lee Nollis, tart girlfriend and corporate takeover guy, we also have staying at the house. And the Lady VP, of course. We also have staying at the house the seemingly normal couple who, you know, one of them is just works for Barnett and the other one is just his perfect housewife. So ultimately, what actually happened is this woman, who seems like just a normal wife who we kind of don't even pay attention to in the episode, she overhears the police saying it was probably murder, and she like drops a vase and she's freaking out. And Jessica's like, that seems suspicious. Like, why are you? And I'm like, it doesn't, not only does it not seem suspicious, but it seems like really obvious that she probably committed the murder. And she's like, uh-oh, I'm gonna get caught. So ultimately, she did commit the murder. And what she did was, she had asked Barnett to promote her husband, and he wouldn't. And so she threw the TV that he was watching in the bathtub with him, as a way of just out of anger, because she felt like, the woman, the lady VP, was getting lots of attention because she was a woman, and Lee Nollis is doing scheming things, and we've got Osborne trying to take over the company, and meanwhile there's her husband who's just working really hard and being steadfast and loyal, and she is the Lady Macbeth who's trying to make things happen. Okay, that is more than enough of me telling you the plot summary. Let's get to the actual discussion of the episode with your involvement.
I'm excited to share my thoughts on the way to Dusty Death, but I'll admit it kind of feels like I'm back in my college media studies class, and I'm hoping my professor likes my observations.
I feel like The Way to Dusty Death has a lot going for it. It's a really intriguing episode. I love the guest stars. I love the fashions, the hat that's worn to the dinner party.
Many of you noted that this episode has lots of really amazing guest stars. No surprise there, right? We love Murder, She Wrote because of that reason. Playing Dutton, the man whose wife is actually our murderer, is Lawrence Pressman, who we've seen before in My Johnny Lies Over the Ocean. He was, of course, the murderer that Jessica confronts when she's pretending to be drunk. And he's also in episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which is how I first knew him, or maybe actually I first knew him from his appearance on Doogie Howser MD, which is a series I grew up with. So the guy that I've been calling Lee Nollis, who is Lord Macbeth, he's actually Richard Boehmer, who is actually, he's only in three episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine as Lee Nollis. They were just three episodes that I had on videotape, and I watched until the tape disintegrated and could recite every line of the dialogue. In fact, a couple of years ago when I did a rewatch of DS9 and I got to those episodes, I was surprised that even after 20 years, I could still recite every single line of dialogue from it. So that's why he's seared into my brain as Lee Nollis, because I'm a Trek nerd. But many of you pointed out that he actually has been in more episodes of Murder, She Wrote than Deep Space Nine. And we first saw him last season in The Days Dwindle Down, and we'll see him again in seasons 8, 9, 10, and 12. So he's a very frequent Murder, She Wrote star. Listen to how Cecilia remembers who this guy is, and take note that she remembers him from something way bigger than a three-episode arc on Deep Space Nine.
All the actors who played Kate Dutton, Tom Dutton, Mr. Farbison, and Spruce Osborne were familiar faces. And then, of course, there was Richard Boehmer, who played Morgan McCormack, who was Tony in West Side Story, and then later was in Twin Peaks.
Some of you made notes about the guest stars that I didn't even make. Listen to what Gina has to say.
When I watched this episode as a teenager, what I think I remembered most was probably Nancy Dessau and Jenny Lee Harrison, because they were in shows that I was watching in syndication at the time: Too Close for Comfort, Three's Company, Respectfully.
Gina points out that our murderer, Kate Dutton, is played by Nancy Dessau, who was in Too Close for Comfort, and was a series regular on that show. And that show ran from 1980 to 1987, so 129 episodes. And this episode of Murder, She Wrote would have been the fall immediately after the end of that series. So it's kind of cool for people who were upset by the end of Too Close for Comfort. It's kind of cool to see her already back on television. Sometimes Murder, She Wrote makes references to other aspects of culture, literature, films. Sometimes those connections are very explicit, and sometimes they're very subtle. It was interesting hearing how you all responded to the parallels to Macbeth in this episode.
And then the main thing, which made me a little embarrassed as an English major, is that the first time I watched this episode a while ago, I did not pick up on the Macbeth vibes at all. And this time it's came out much more clearly. And then when I saw the episode title, it kind of confirmed that.
Cecilia points out that Anne Hathaway is kind of an interesting character name. And of course, she's referring to Shakespeare's wife is named Anne Hathaway. So again, we have this connection to Shakespeare and Macbeth with the character names. And that is the name of the woman that I just call Lady VP, which I suppose is not very nice of me. I should give her a proper name. And she is played by Andrea Markovici. Like me, Jacob saw parallels to Trial by Error. He writes that he thought it was interesting how the story happens. A lot of the story takes place in the boardroom. And that he felt like there were two different groups of people. There's the people among the board, and then there's the wives. And that makes Jessica a particularly interesting character because, of course, she can move between the two groups as someone who is, you know, a woman and an older woman like many of the wives. And also that in the beginning of the episode, she mentions Frank and that he used to sell real estate. So she always positions herself very much as a wife and a widow, even as she's a powerful woman who's now on the board of this corporation. So for Jacob, it seemed like the episode really had that trial by error feel, and also this sense of like these two camps of people. Many of you seem to agree with me about the interpretation of women's place in society in this episode. Listen to what Gina has to say about how wives in the 1980s are expected to perform.
This episode seems to lean into exploring gender roles, both within marriage and in business. We have Nancy DeSoto's character, Kate, talking about not keeping up with these modern women and the roles and responsibilities that a wife has. And is it like an 80s trope, this notion of the dutiful wife doing whatever it takes to support their husband's ascension into power? We see this play out not with one character, but with two characters, both with Kate and with Joanna Pettit's character, Virginia McCormick, both women ready to kill to get their husband into the C-suite. Very, very 80s. It kind of feels Dallas-y, dynasty type of sensibility. And I don't think we've seen something like this in the series up to this point.
Like Gina, Anne also was drawn to the themes of feminism in this episode.
But the thing that I enjoy the most about the episode is actually the feminism that's running through it. It seems to come at a time when the role of women in the workplace was changing, and I like the way that the women in this episode take center stage, even though they may not be center stage in their careers. The two women who actually attempted murder, one successfully, one not, were seen as or viewed themselves as partners with their husbands in their husbands' careers. Whereas you have Anne Hathaway, an interesting name choice because she was the wife of Shakespeare and somebody who is often overlooked as a woman in her own right and seen as an appendage of her husband, here taking center stage as a career woman and somebody who doesn't need a husband to get ahead and coming out on top at the end of the episode. So you have these kind of two opposing types of women. Somebody who's an old model of woman who is the homemaker and the new model of woman who is in the workplace and not needing a man to get ahead. But contrasting with that, you also have the role of Serena, who is again falling back on a stereotype of a woman who is relying on her youth and beauty to get ahead. So the writers are kind of reminding us that it's not as simple as just throwing away all of the things we've learned there's a new feminist paradise coming through. We still have a lot of patriarchal norms that are coming through. And sitting outside all of this is Jessica, who seems to occupy her own world and her own rarefied sphere, which is one thing I really love about the show, is that Jessica gets to do things that other women didn't get to do. And when I was a little kid watching this show, it didn't seem weird for me. And I got to grow up thinking that women could do these things because of Jessica. And it's only now, looking back as an adult, that I realize, no, Jessica's a special case in many of these episodes.
You know, I talk about this a lot, that even though I've seen all of these episodes a million times and I've grown up with them, that often I forget who the actual murderer is and why they did it. I think in this episode, it's pretty easy to remember. Somebody's going to kill this guy to get power, right? Like, that's the entire premise of the episode. But who and why specifically, you know, it's maybe forgettable. And Jacob seemed to agree with me on that front. You know, he wrote in that he says, I don't think most people remember who the murderer was or why even the murder was committed. And he felt like Barnett, Duncan Barnett, our murder victim, was, in his words, a butt neck. Jacob writes, he makes the episode unpleasant with his behavior at the dinner table the night of his murder. So he feels like he's not a very sympathetic murder victim. But I think I agree with you, Jacob, that the actual, like, who done it is sometimes less interesting than all of the process leading up to it. So Jacob says, the interesting thing in this episode is by far the characters and their side stories. And I agree with you absolutely. Like, it's, you know, Lady Macbeth and the Lady VP and all that sort of intrigue and what's going on with the corporate takeover and the mole and the girlfriend who turns out to be a sort of double agent, even though she's completely underestimated as just a sort of tart. I mean, it's really a densely layered episode. And so maybe who actually did it and why is less important than all of that other stuff. And of course, it wouldn't be an episode of the Cabot Cove Gazette without a discussion of clothing.
Jessica's clothes, which I loved, loved, loved everything that she wore in this episode, even her pajamas and her robe. That first outfit, the cream and black sweater with the matching cream and black shoes, ugh, were just amazing. Okay, so I'm going to say something controversial. Don't cancel me. But when I was a teen, you know, I'd watch Golden Girls and Murder, She Wrote. I love Golden Girls. I have the DVD. But I have to say that I used to think that the Golden Girls were dressed a little frumpy. Yes, I said it. They just seem frumpy to me. But Jessica always seems so tailored and chic and cosmopolitan, right? And fitted. And I just really think that this episode really defines that. And I just love looking at all of the things that she's wearing in this episode.
Like Gina, I wrote down a description of Jessica's opening outfit, a navy shift with an oversized white cardigan with navy trim. It's all very coordinated. It looks so classy. I mean, we just love that Lansbury pushed, as we've talked about on this podcast before, that Lansbury pushed for Jessica's clothing to get more sophisticated as Jessica sort of grew in wealth and fame. And I think the wardrobe department did such a lovely job of making her always have that combination of class and femininity and grace, but also style. I want to thank everyone who wrote in and sent their recordings or emailed their thoughts about this episode. We weren't able to include everyone in this episode, but I hope that we can play this game again and that we'll be able to get to more of you. I loved reading your messages. I loved hearing your thoughts. And I especially appreciated those of you who included messages of support for the podcast. Thank you so much for listening. And as we enter this new era of the Cabot Cove Gazette, I hope you'll stick with me.
I really enjoy the show.
But I love this podcast so much. Thank you both. Thank you, thank you, thank you for giving us a place for us land stands to channel our glee. And I really hope when you get to the last flight of the Dixie Damsel, you like that one too, because it's my second favorite episode of all time. Keep doing what you're doing. Take care.
One of the things the Cabot Cove Gazette is known for is the way that TJ and I tend to needle each other and pick on each other. And of course, it wouldn't be the Cabot Cove Gazette without that continuing even in TJ's absence. So here's a critique from Salem about one of our very first episodes, Hooray for Homicide.
For a podcast that talks about all the guest stars in Murder, She Wrote, how could you not know or mention Crystal from this episode? The murderer, Crystal, is actually Melissa Sue Anderson, Mary from Little House on the Prairie. It's mind-boggling.
So thank you, thank you, thank you to Anne, Cecilia, Jacob, Gina, Salem, and everybody else we didn't get to. Love you to all of you land stands out there. And we'll be back next week with a special guest host. But for now, I'm Bridget Keys. This is the Cabot Cove Gazette, and we'll catch you next time. The Cabot Cove Gazette's theme song is Reaching the Sky by Alexander Nakarada, used under Creative Commons license. You can find us on social media. We're Cabot Cove Gazette on Facebook and @Cove Gazette on Instagram and Twitter.